I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being's Unheard Cuts. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Mary Carr. Download the MP3 of my produced show with her at onbeing.org. All right, stop talking because let's do the official, just in case
okay,
we
then.
Wander into any important territory. Can he hear you?
Paul, he just handed me a cup. Oh, he's just gone into the. There he is.
I think that's what. I think the door opened, maybe. Oh,
oh yeah,
is the door open?
I just was bringing her in her tea. I'm sorry. I can turn Krista down a little bit in the headphones, too.
Thanks for the tea, Paul.
I also, I've interviewed Christian Wiman. And,
I love Christian.
Yeah,
he
invited me out to speak at that at ISM, and then I watched your I saw you there, and I saw his introduction of you. And when I interviewed Christian, I felt like of all the people I'd spoken with, that world he grew up in. That he and I both grew up in that immersive religious world, which I know recognized
so did Phil.
It.
Both of Phil's parents were Pentecostal ministers.
Oh.
And his mother was an actual evangelist.
Yeah, well, Pentecostals were ordaining women 100 years ago. I mean, whatever you think of their theology, there was
right? Right. Well, their politics have changed.
Yes, they have. they have.
But, you got to love old...
So you may know then that I start my interviews by wondering about the spiritual background of someone's childhood. And clearly your spiritual background expansively defined. And clearly you didn't grow up, your spiritual background was not religious. And in fact, the stories that you've told in your memoirs that so many people know, have to do with a childhood that was awash with a lot of violence and chaos. Not only violence and chaos, but plenty of that, and rape, and your mother having a psychotic break and wielding a butcher knife at you. And so, I want to ask if you think about what was the spiritual canvas kind of in and amidst that inside you, and I'm sure you would answer this question differently at different points in your life, but how would you think about that now?
A lot of terror.
Yeah.
It was a lot of terror and fear and suffering and loathing and self-loathing. And, it's the great thing about a really miserable childhood is the rest of your life looks like you've improved things. When really all you've done is grown up and gotten car keys and a credit card, but you feel like you've made some great advance.
Just by virtue of growing up.
Well, just by you don't live there anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a smart thing I did.
Yeah. And you have said, although again, that was not there was not overt spirituality in your childhood or religiosity. You wrote, "Poets were my first priests and poetry itself my first altar."
I think that's right.
Yeah. Did you think of it that way then, or do you think of it that way in hindsight?
I think I always sort of did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was the place, it was the, it would make a lot of sense to Freud. I mean, it was the place I had contact with both my mother and my father, is around language in a way. I mean, obviously we all have contact via language, but my father's stories and my mother's love of literature.
Yeah. Which strikes me as somebody who grew up in that part of the world kind of as really unusual that your mother had love of language. I mean, you talk about
being able
to calm her down or draw her out of a sulk by reciting E. E. Cummings or A. A. Milne, but that's amazing to me.
I know, right?
Yeah.
No, she was a marvel for that place and time. What would I have had to be? I don't know. A hooker, a serial killer, a poet. that's kind of the lineup.
Right. I have always thought of you as a memoirist first and a poet second. And as I delved into this, I realized that that's not the way you see it. That it's a common – I see a lot of people who interview you coming at you with that realization. And also, I saw you say to somebody else that it breaks your heart.
It's hard to break my heart anymore. My heart was so broken for so long, and it's so healed in some ways, I think.
But have people tried to talk you? I mean, the way I reacted to it when I saw you say that was, but your prose itself is poetic. Is a form of poetry and
good for me.
Yeah,
I see. Good for me.
Yeah,
I hope so. That'd be great.
Well, and you also talk about you write about how as you were growing up in that chaotic childhood that poetry was your altar, but that first person coming of age stories also gave you this hope as a child that you would come through. You would get through it.
Well, I don't know that I would go that far. Mm-hmm. I think I had a sense. I read those memoirs starting obviously when I was very young because I wanted to know how you became a writer. Mm-hmm. I thought there would be something in there, about how to get that done. And it seemed like such an exalted. I remember when my son was 5, if you ask him what he wanted to be, he said, a trapeze artist or a rabbi. And I was thinking, both of those things are more likely for him to have become than I think for me to become a poet or a writer, given where I grew up.
Yeah.
So it was I think I say somewhere in one of my books that when I was in 7th or 8th grade, I got in trouble for being mouthy, which often happened to me, but in a math class, and my junior high school principal actually said this sentence to me. He said, "If you persist in this dream that you're going to become a poet, you will wind up no more than a common prostitute." Can you imagine saying that to a little girl?
No.
But that's how unlikely it was. There wasn't. Other than in my house, there wasn't poetry anywhere. Well, on the other hand, I think the idiom of that place, my father's stories and the way the way people talked was super poetic, very beautiful.
You were writing in the Paris Review, and I so recognize this. You said people who didn't live pre-internet can't grasp how devoid of ideas life in my hometown was.
How one just couldn't get books.
Yeah. Or you said the bookstore sold Bibles the size of coffee tables.
Right.
But that was the book. And because my childhood was the religiously immersive one in that part of the world, spent a lot of time with the Bible and its poetry. There was a lot in there, but you're right. There wasn't much else offered.
Right. You would hear about something. Mm-hmm. You would hear about a poet or, in my house, you'd read T.S. Eliot and Eliot would mention, Mallarmé and Baudelaire or whatever, Valerie or whomever in the essays. And you couldn't find books by them.
Yeah.
I had Shakespeare. In some ways, I had that Riverside Shakespeare in my house. I probably read the way those plays, the way people, in other households were reading the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Both dark poetic books with a lot of trouble.
Right.
And a lot of redemption. So.
Yeah. Well, the full spectrum of the human drama, for sure. As I started, I heard your interview with Terry Gross, and I was so intrigued as you talked about your religious life now, And then when I started rereading you and reading The Art of Memoir, reading, you know, some of your newer works and Lit, I just found myself tracing kind of, you know, spiritual life as it has unfolded. And it seems to me also even, and I don't think I want to go here immediately, but that there's a sense in which many of the ways you talk about writing memoir is kind of, there's a spiritual discipline to that.
I think that's true. I think that's really true. I mean, in an age when even to use the word truth, or even to say the word truth, it always comes now with you know, finger squiggles around it. You know, it comes with quotes around it.
Yeah.
As though, how dare one presume to know the truth? But I believed that one could. I believe that I guess for me, having such complicated feelings about my much-loved, you know, fairly troubled family, I just felt like I had to figure out what had happened and why I felt so bad.
Yeah.
Or I just wasn't going to make it. I mean, it was either. So the idea of trying to, you know, kind of even believing that there was such a thing as truth and that it could possibly in any way be knowable by a person through self-reflection and, you know, therapy and talking to people and fasting and prayer and, you know, eventually talking to Jesus,
yeah.
You know, that there had to be some way of that. I believe that, you know, that the truth would set me free. I believe that. Hmm. I was an early proponent of that idea. Because as I said, you know, I was lied to so often and with such conviction by such really talented liars. Just some really able artist.
Well, and the people who were supposed to be actually teaching you the truth about life, I mean, in a perfect world, right?
Right. I mean, we're all lied to,
yeah,
by our parents.
That's it.
I mean, let's face it. We're all lied to, either intentionally or not intentionally. Mm-hmm. But again, in an alcoholic family, I think you start with that big lie, you know, I'm not drunk. I mean, it's just, you're just told that so many times. Or everything's okay was those are the two big ones.
Mm-hmm.
In a family where there's a lot of hard drinking, you know, people are always saying, oh, it's fine, you know, it's going to be okay. No, everything's all right. But last night you were wagging firearms in our kitchen, Mom.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. So, I guess I did. I had some belief that that truth was a knowable thing. And, you know, again, my mother, you know, was a seeker. I mean, she went back to college when I was a kid and, you know, she studied philosophy. I mean, you know, she spent a lot, probably too much time for somebody as moody as she was with French existentialist. But, you know, and she did yoga. You know, nobody did yoga.
Wow.
I mean, you know, and she, you know, the few times she took us to church, she took us to the Christian Science Church,
mm-hmm.
Which she didn't belong to because she didn't belong to anything. But, you know, she was a kind of a seeker. In a strange way, you know, she did read philosophy, and she was I guess all readerly people are seekers, aren't we? I mean, is that not true?
Yes, and also attending to interior life, which is not necessarily such an American thing to do.
Right. It's very unseemly.
Yeah.
It's very unseemly. I mean, I think of, you know, Josh Schenck has that great book, I think, about called Lincoln's Melancholy, about Lincoln's depression and about the kind of and I think, again, the blessing, I can see it now that I'm not in it, but the blessing of a really depressive early life and a really, I mean, I don't think my childhood, there were plenty of worse childhoods, but I think it does deepen you to be dark-minded.
If it doesn't, and if it doesn't kill you, right?
If it doesn't kill you, it does. And it gives you a lot of, I think, if you're lucky or if you come out the other end of it, it's also brings you to compassion, I think, for other people.
So when you say in The Art of Memoir, in some ways writing a memoir is knocking yourself out with your own fist if it's done right. What is that what you're talking about, that hard place you have to go to?
Well, I think we remember through a filter of who we are now.
Yeah.
So we remember, you know, we don't remember being 3 feet tall and illiterate and flat broke, you know, as we are when we're all children.
Yeah.
And unemployed. You know, we remember, I'm going to grow up and be okay and be competent. And so at some point, I think in every memoir, I have to disabuse myself. Or somehow by going back and writing things down, I re-arrive at a place or at a self, closer to a self in the past, that not only remembers events but can really feel myself inside a 8-year-old body or a 10-year-old body or a 30-year-old body, you know, that can really feel what it's like to be hungover when I haven't had a drink in almost 30 years. So going back in there is not cheerful.
It's also there's this phenomenon that you write about in yourself and also in your students that when people first start writing, they're often actually not writing about the person they really are. And you had this
always.
You had this epigraph from Thomas Merton to The Art of Memoir, which is, you know, just a very poetic way of saying, you know, he said every one of us is shadowed by an illusory person, a false self. I wind my experiences around myself and cover myself with glory like bandages in order to make myself perceptible to myself and to the world. As if I were an invisible body that could only become visible when something visible covered its surface. But then, do we not even we don't even know how to reach for? We don't know how to express that true self.
Well, we don't know what it is mostly. I mean, I always say. I just put out that little book about from a graduation speech.
Yes, I've got that. Yeah.
Now go out there. Yeah. And I think when I'm at some point, and I think this comes from, trying to meditate over a period, I still think of myself as a rank beginner, but over a period of decades, I've been trying to do this. And if in those moments of terror or judgment of other people or of myself or thinking I know things I don't know. I mean, when I first got sober, I had this sort of Virgil, this kind of spiritual guide through this kind of spiritual guide through the hell of early sobriety who would say to me when I would tell her something I was afraid of, she would say, "What is your source of information?" And 99% of the time it was, "I thought it up."
Okay.
You know, it wasn't like the doctor called me and said that bruise is bone cancer. It's like I was sitting there and I looked at it and I thought, you know what? Or, you know, the guy with the Jaguar knew that I was in a hurry and got my parking place, before I got there. And the universe was conspiring. I mean, I had all kinds of magical thinking. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, the process of trying to become curious in those moments of real discomfort about what's going on. It doesn't always free you from suffering per se, but I don't know. I have a girlfriend who's a mother with young children, and she called me one day to tell me she had lost her mind and she was incapable. She needed to call the police and check into a mental institution. Because she had slapped one of her children who was little, five. And I was like, well, yeah. I can imagine anybody who's had one knows about wanting to slap one. they can call you poopy head at the wrong moment. You know, they can. But she said, no, you don't understand. I can't stop crying. I can't stop crying. I've apologized. I really think I'm losing my mind. And I said to her, well, who's noticing that you're losing your mind?
Right.
And I think, and she said, huh, you know, I mean, I asked her that and she actually thought about it for a minute. And I said, you know, that notice herself, it's easier to do with somebody else than with one's own moments of insanity. I said, you know, for me, that notice herself that notices, I said, you know, first off, if you thought slapping your kid was a good idea, I'd be worried about you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you're calling me to defend having slapped your kid. You're calling me because you're abject over having done it. And that means you're a good mother, you know. And second, stop apologizing. She doesn't even remember by this point that you hit her.
Right.
It's 2 hours later.
Okay.
And this is all about you and has nothing to do with her. And third, how did you get here? Well, I haven't slept. You know, I'm working full time. I've got 2 kids. I haven't eaten. It's like, yeah, okay, well, maybe have a sandwich. You know, I mean, maybe it's time to have a sandwich. You know, maybe. But just all, you know, I mean, for me, the voice of God never gives me a long-term plan. It never helps me with any kind of lottery number or anything. But that voice that says, you know, you need to sit down and have something to eat or it's not going to be good to be you anymore.
And that note, so just that noticing, in that note, in that noticing self, that also is you. And is God connected to that? Is God in that somehow for you or close to that?
I think not only is that also you, I think that's the real you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's the real you. And the frightened, angry self is often, you know, an animal self.
Yeah.
And that's us too, obviously. I'm not trying to say that you're, you know, the devil made you do it, you know, and that you're somehow cut off from those other aspects of how you feel and behave. You know, you're responsible for all of it. But yeah, I think for me, coming to have a place inside myself or my spiritual practice or going to Mass or taking communion or trying to be more mindful or praying, you know, just really trying not to kill everybody on the subway every day. I mean, that's the goal for me. It's not lofty. I don't want to be Mother Teresa, you know. I don't want to be an asshole. I can't say that on the radio, can I? What else
that's
can
okay.
I say?
We can cut it out. Yeah, just don't worry. So speak frankly and we'll...
Is there another word I can say?
I'm not actually sure about that one. That one may be on the fence. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
you'll figure it
out. We'll figure it out. Yeah.
Okay.
You'll say enough other interesting things.
I hope so.
Without swearing that we might be able to use. You said something. You spoke in a similar way in this book, Now Go Out There, actually, and the kind of subtitle is And Get Curious, which was a graduation speech, right? Graduation taken from us.
Right.
Commencement address.
Can you believe they gave me an honorary degree? I mean, I'm so undegreeable. But they
yes, I did, actually.
It was so fun. It was really fun. I dreaded it. I've never dreaded anything more than that graduation speech.
Why?
If you're a college professor, you give talks all the – I mean, you know, what is a college professor? It's somebody who can talk for 50 minutes, and this – I only had to talk for 20. But the audience was so diverse, and, you know, you're trying to sort of inspire people. And there had been a huge uproar that they were even having me be the commencement speaker because there had been a rumor on campus – that it was supposed to be Jimmy Fallon, which was like a complete lie. But you ask a bunch of college professors, do you want like the local poet or, you know, old maid school teacher, or do you want Jimmy Fallon? It'll be Jimmy Fallon every time. So So there were like protests, and people wrote the chancellor and said, you know, can't we afford a real graduation speaker?
Do
we have to have this person? No, it was terrible. It was a huge thing on the internet around Syracuse, like how awful this was, and that I was going to be the commencement speaker. And so my level of anxiety when I was working on the speech, and then as I often do once I've worked on a talk, I just, you know, at some point you have to just let go of the outcome. And you say, look, you know, if they boo and they throw things, you know, it'll last for 20 minutes and then it'll be over. And, you know, I'll have an anecdote. It'll be fine. I'll go back to my life. Yeah. It's a short period of time. So it's a – but that was really sort of what I was expecting. So when I got such a great response, it was astonishing. Mm. To me, it was completely unexpected and not, and then to have it, you know, people want to look at it on the internet and have people want to publish a book of it and all of that was surprising. So,
it's wise. I mean, I was just kind of following on what you were just saying a minute ago about that, you know, that primal side of us, but it's not all of us, and it's not, I mean, you said in this, in Now Go Other, you said the opposite of love is fear, and you told these graduates that fear can take that expensively educated brain of yours and reduce it to the state of a dog growling over a bone. But you did say, right? Ask yourself, who's noticing how scared you are, and that's where your soul is, and if you can get curious about it, you get less scared, which is...
I think that's right. I mean, if you can just sort of see these scary events as kind of practice to notice what's going on.
Yeah.
It's interesting because most of that feeling that you have so often when you're terrified, it really is the same feeling our, you know, Neolithic ancestors had when the saber-toothed tiger was bounding out of the... I mean, you feel like you're going to die. I mean, the feeling people have when they're heartbroken or they're terrified is, I'm going to die. I will die from this grief. I will die from this fear. And if you can wake up into it and look at it and just sort of say, well, yeah, I'm going to feel this way for X amount of time. What's causing this? It is... And accept that it's a normal part. I mean, I think we live, especially in this country, with all these kind of grinning, airbrushed public. I mean, even look at our politicians. They're just so, I'm not going to go into it, but it's just the whole glossy media blitz that we're constantly exposed to. I mean, one feels one's butt lie down on the back of your leg. You just think, well, this isn't right. There's something wrong about this.
Yeah, and I, something I like about the way you talk about getting real or getting in touch with your true self is also you're not, you know, you're proposing very gentle ways in, like not, you're not saying analyze it or interrogate it. You're saying, you know, just noticing, getting curious. Those are soft.
Right.
Those are soft actions. They're much closer and easier to get at than attacking a problem, right?
But it's also one's instinct. Mm-hmm. If you are afraid,
is
to make it stop.
Right. Right.
If you're afraid, if you're anxious, if you're angry, if you're heartbroken, one's fear is, you know, one's instinct around it is usually violent.
Right.
And that interior violence is so, I mean, the problem with being judgmental, says one of the most judgmental people on the planet, is that the voice you use to criticize everybody else is the exact same voice you use to criticize yourself with. So, yeah, if we could just walk around in our separate little bubbles, throwing lightning bolts at people who got our parking places or got ahead of us in Starbucks, I suppose. But there is something about trying to find a gentler way to respond to what normally makes us feel, or makes me anyway, have a violent reaction, which is get me out of here, get me away from this, make this stop.
Yeah.
If you can find a way to occupy it. It's also, I think you find yourself saying true things. I remember when I first met my agent and I was a young writer and I wanted so desperately to have an agent and to write a memoir and be able to buy a Toyota. like that's what I wanted, was people to buy a used car but not have to take public transport to my kids after school. Hmm. And I just remember her saying to me, oh, you should write a memoir. And I was like, yeah, well, I don't know how to do that. And she says, well, you just write a proposal and send it to me. And I said, well, I don't know. I'm a poet. I don't know what that would look like. And I would never have said that. Instead, I would have faked that I knew what she was talking about. And then as the date came when I was supposed to give it to her, I would have found a reason not to do it or to get drunk or to, you know, not show up, just not even try in a way.
Before you met her, before you really embarked on this career of writing, or maybe even really saw yourself as a writer, you pretty much, I don't know, there's somewhere that you note the connection between breakdown and breakthrough.
Right. Is it a nervous breakdown or a nervous breakthrough?
Yeah.
That's right. That's a good question.
Yeah. Because you had both, right?
Well, I think every nervous breakdown is a nervous breakthrough if you let it be.
Yeah.
I really do. I really believe that.
Yeah.
I believe that it's the old Hemingway saw of, you know, all of us are broken and you know, you can, some of us get stronger in the broken places.
Yeah. I mean, here's something else you said. You called the place you went the mental Marriott.
It was.
And you in this graduation speech, now, which isn't now this book, now go out there, you wrote, the loony bin is where I learned that as deep as a wound is, that's how deep the healing can be.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you think of it that way, I mean, however high the fever is that you have, when it breaks, you're that much, you've come that much further forward. And the sense of resilience one has, I think. I mean, I'd spent my whole life, my mother, you know, was in a loony bin when I was little. I spent my whole life thinking, I'm going to go crazy like my mother. And then my kid was, I don't know, 3, and I went crazy like my mother. And there I was, you know, checking into a mental institution. It was such a relief. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, no, but I got there, and it was, you know, it was a lot of codependent nurses asking me how I was feeling and trying to make me little cups of tea and you know, sitting around rooms with people, you know, moving your Monopoly tiles real slow. I mean, it was a restful, quiet place where I got to say, yeah, it's hard to be me. It's been hard to be me, everybody. Remember I was saying that before? Well, here we have external evidence that I might not be up to it.
And the word quiet actually comes up a lot when you're writing about that time. And there were a lot of hard things you were having to face. Your marriage was failing, but in quite a few places you use the word quiet. I think there's this one place I think you say that there, you know, you started to write differently, that there was a polished quiet around the writing, which is such a lovely image.
I think I just you know, that idea of trying to say something small and simple and as true as possible.
Yeah.
Just the really, in some ways, starting to write about what I wanted to write about when I was in the fourth grade. I mean, I have that journal from 1965, so I was 10 years old, where I say, you know, when I grow up, I will write one half poetry and one half autobiography. And what else do I say? I say, I'm not very successful as a little girl. When I grow up, I will probably be a mess. Mm. And or something like that. So I just started, instead of trying to act like I knew what was going on, to write as if I were a mess. which is how I felt. It suddenly became, there just felt like there was less posing to it. I mean, obviously, when you write anything, you're constructing a voice and you're constructing a self, and there's artifice to it. You're trying to make the sentences sound more interesting than you are in your normal life. So, but I did feel like I got closer to who I really was at some point, and I stopped trying to sound like Nabokov, say, and started trying to sound like, you know, who's this genius, and started trying to sound like, you know, this, you know, Aborigine from East Texas.
I was with, a couple of weeks ago, I was with, do you know Sylvia Boorstein? She's a Buddhist teacher.
No.
She's wonderful. She's on the West Coast. And I did a little bit, I did some sitting with her, and she introduced this concept which seemed so radical to me, which was about not so much having a mantra or even following your breath, but about sitting and just kind of noticing, taking in the natural peace and ease of your mind. Okay, I know, and that's how I felt, right? Because
you're like the natural peace and ease of my mind.
Well, so, and, you know, that was such a crazy, you know, just such a foreign idea to me. But then if you think about it that way, right? Like if you think that all the noise and all the chaos actually is, you know, something you're doing, that it wasn't there,
right.
It's not pre-existent, it doesn't have to be that way. And I was thinking about that as I was reading you about being at the Mental Marriott and what settled. It feels like you started to, that natural peace and ease of your mind, which you'd never been able to, allowed to experience, was present to you in a way, or at least, I mean,
well,
I think
I started
in
praying.
Moments, right? Do we? You started praying, yeah.
I started praying. Mm-hmm. I got on my knees. I mean, you know, it's, you don't have to be, even I, you know, after whatever, 35 years of agnosticism, you know, when you land in a mental institution, you have to say to yourself, you know, my ways of moving through the world are not succeeding.
Yeah.
I'm in custodial care. Right. People won't let me have sharp knives. There's or flames. I mean, there's a reason that people are looking at me with concern. So I love that, though. I remember thinking at the time, asking this woman what she prayed for, and I would pray to stand it. I would pray to, let me get through a day. Let me just get through this day without killing myself or anybody else. And I remember this woman saying, I thought of that when you said, I said, what do you pray for? She said, oh, I pray every day for a joyful day that's full of serenity. Really?
Yeah, right.
You can pray for
Tell
that?
Tell me another one, yeah.
Well, so what happened when you, I want to know what happened with Sylvia Boorstein when you started.
Well, okay, well, so I don't know if all this will make it into the show, but I will share. So once she told this story, which to me also I couldn't stop thinking about, which was about, you know, 20 years ago, she was watching Larry King interviewing a Swami, you know, some kind of wise man. And Larry King, after talking to this man for a while, he leaned forward and he said to him, how did you get it so quiet in there? And the Swami said, it is quiet in there. We make it noisy. So I've been thinking about that for a couple of days. And then comes this morning where she says, all right, she said, today, all I want you to do is just kind of feel the natural peace and ease of your mind. And my story is different from yours, but there, you know, I also, that's not even something I ever probably wanted or thought would be interesting, for one thing, right?
Well, right. It sounds boring.
Yeah, it sounds boring. But it's actually there, right? I mean, I don't think, I couldn't hold it for more than a few minutes, but...
It's up in there?
Yeah.
It's up in
that
there,
quiet,
it is.
That peace and ease. Well, it's like, it's elemental, right? It's like all these layers are on top of it, but... But seriously, when, you know, those descriptions you have in Lit of then, you know, your marriage is troubled, but even in the midst of that, you're taking it in differently, right? And then how the writing, how you started to be able to write.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I love that thing Thomas Keating says about practicing mindfulness, and and that you, it's sort of like, you know, there's a bunch of water that has mud and silt in it, and the longer you practice, the more that just kind of settles to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't feel any peace. You might practice for days and weeks, and it's just cloudy and noisy. And he says, what you don't realize is that healing is happening.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff, by doing that, you are settling it. But you don't notice it because it hasn't settled yet. You have to just, that how difficult just to keep sitting there.
Yeah. Yes. And unfamiliar. Right, unfamiliar,
oh,
just to sit with it and let there not be a kind of a...
Right, because I would rather, you know, mm-hmm. snort cocaine and, you know, make out with the FedEx guy, yeah. Yeah, right?
Yeah. The story of how you came... I mean, this was interesting to me because I hadn't put all this together until I was really reading kind of into the sweep of your work, that kind of falling apart and becoming spiritually awake. And I don't know whether you would have called it that or not, and becoming a writer, becoming the writer you'd wanted to be, maybe dreamed you could be. And then also, in that same chapter, being baptized in the Catholic Church at 40.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was some years after that. I think I was probably, let's see, that would have been 1989. I think I was in the bin in 1990. So it was maybe 6 years later.
Okay.
So I've been meditating and praying for 4 or 5 years before my son came in his little Spider-Man pajamas and said, you know, I want to go to church. And I said, darkly, why? And he said, to see if God's there.
Yeah.
You know, which was kind of the only sentence he could have said that would have got me up off my butt, away from the New York Times and that bagel, and into a church somebody told me we could go to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You made this kind of public confession of your Catholicism in Poetry Magazine in 2005, and although you had you write about how poetry always seemed intellectually respectable, where religion wasn't.
Oh yeah,
right.
I mean, being a Catholic is like being,
yeah, right.
You know, oh my God.
Yeah. So confessing your Catholicism in Poetry Magazine was...
it was anathema. I mean, that's where, you know, that's where T.S. Eliot first published Prufrock. That's where all the dark and French-influenced symbolist for the past century blazed a trail into existential misery. For me to come in and be Catholic, oh, my God. It was bad enough being a Texan and then a redneck and then not educated. And then this just proved out all my detractors, you know.
Oh, yeah. Here's what you wrote. To confess my unlikely Catholicism in poetry, I think we can put this on public radio, feels like an act of perversion kinkier than any dildo-wielding dominatrix could manage on HBO's Real Sex Extra.
Forgot I wrote that. Gosh, how dare I?
But there is such what's the word I want to use? I mean, poetry and prayer and liturgy are
right.
so much of a piece, right? I mean,
right.
They're so kindred to each other, and
it's also. I mean, I remember when I first went to the Catholic Church. Which I did. I took my son. He was the one who wanted to go to church. And I sat with a stack of papers and graded them in the back. I had a latte. I'm not even making this up. I brought a latte. I sat in the back. And
wow.
He was in Sunday school, and I was just cynically there marking time. And something about the faith of the people. It wasn't the spectacle or the... You know, Walter Pater and all those aesthetes, you know, always talked about the grandeur and the ritual and all the gold stuff. And and all of that. None of that I cared about. I mean, I care about more now, maybe, just because I've gotten used to it. But at the time, I was kind of repelled by it. But just people saying their prayers. People saying, you know, please pray for my daughter who's having surgery. People bringing hope and terror into a public forum and saying, I'm afraid and I need these things to happen for in order to go on. And isn't that what poetry is? I mean, poetry is that place for the, you know, most disturbed among us, you know, try to find the most exalted language to convey those hopes and those despairs, you know, or that desperation.
Hang on, I just got a message from behind the glass that they want to adjust your microphone, I think.
What did I do? Oh, I moved back.
Don't move. When I'm sitting, you're more comfortable leaning back, so what I want you to do is to pull your chair forward so you can still lean back.
All righty then.
One more inch.
Good. Okay. So we have to go back and say everything all over again?
No, we don't. We don't.
Yep. Okay. All righty then.
Yeah.
If you need another cup of tea to make up for that.
Good.
Okay. Is he gone? No.
No, he's still fondling my mic. There he goes.
Okay. Well, and so I, you know, I was also not religious for a long time and then went to divinity school in my 30s. And one of the things that shocked me in a lovely way was how the Psalms, you know, which are this poetry and prayer book at the center of the Bible. I mean, they bring, that is, they are, you know, so much about bringing every, all the mess, every dark instinct in human life, from murderous rage, right, to...
Right, and rage at God.
Yeah, to, I mean, into the presence of God, right? And so just what you're saying, I mean, but I don't think... that's not actually something we've always done. I mean, I didn't grow up doing it in church, but it is there in the text.
Well, you were one of those nice Protestant girls.
That's right.
Weren't you?
Yeah, and also the whole enterprise was about, you know, suppressing or hiding these messy things, sinful things, trying to make sure they wouldn't happen, which was a lost cause.
Yeah, that's hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I was lucky that I converted when I was so old, because all the shame and stuff that everybody else felt at confession, I was so beyond all that. Mm. I was like, oh, you want to try to make me feel ashamed? I've been ashamed all my life. you can't make me feel more ashamed. So
I want to read this from St. Augustine's City of God, which you put at the top of the chapter. One of the chapters in Lit, which talks about where you're talking about becoming religious. And to me, this is just such a beautiful demonstration of, you know, what we're talking about, the poetry that is there in deep in the heart of the tradition. Late have I loved you, O beauty, so ancient and so new. Late have I loved you, for behold, you were within me and I outside. And I sought you outside, and in my unloveliness fell upon those lovely things which you have made. You were with me, and I was not with you. I was kept from you by those things. Yet had they not been in you, they would not have been at all. You called and cried to me to break open my deafness, and you sent forth your beams, and you shone upon me and chased away my blindness. You breathed fragrance upon me, and I drew in my breath, and now do pant for you.
Isn't that great? I got chills when you read that. And now do pant for you. Good old St. Augustine. Boy.
Yeah.
Probably our first sex addict, right?
That's right. Well, that and actually...
Yeah, it was my favorite line of his. Give me chastity, Lord, but not yet.
Right. Right, which is a good segue to something else I wanted to ask you about, which is your notion of sacred carnality in the art of memoir. it's a little bit of a stretch from St. Augustine being the first sex addict. But I do love that language, and talk about what you are thinking when you talk about sacred carnality in the art of memoir.
I mean, what I liked about the Catholic Church that I didn't find in the Protestant tradition, which in some ways you would think would be more suited to me. They have women priests. They're not so doctrinaire. They're not, you know, they fake that they don't believe what their doctrine says more easily. They're quote unquote progressive in some ways. There's a body on the cross. Even just being in Mass, that you stand up and kneel down, that you move in unison. That I know a lot of cradle Catholics complain about how sheep-like you feel, or they're like dumb cattle or something like that. But I sort of found it like, it's like being in, you know, hip-hop class. You know, when you move like everybody, you kind of feel like you are like them. And the idea of that we're hunks of meat, you know, incarnate, you know, in meat, that it's not metaphorical, the idea of Jesus and the Eucharist. It's not a metaphor that you're going to be renewed. It's not a metaphor of his body or his teaching, quote unquote, or his love or whatever. It's his body. Yeah. That's his body. Is what that's supposed to be about. It's so lurid. And I remember looking at the body on the cross and saying to my son, that I don't even remember whether I ever wrote about this or not, but I remember looking at it before we were baptized and saying, you know, I don't get this whole crucifixion thing. It's so awful. I mean, this suffering, beaten, you know, critter, you know, nailed up there. It's just so gross. You know, why don't they just have, you know, you say the jump rope rhymes and then you're redeemed. And my kid, who was young, like maybe, I don't know, 8 or 9, said, who would pay attention to that?
Right.
You know, and he said, this is like Pulp Fiction. My mother, the one time I left him with her, had let him watch Pulp Fiction when he was like 7 years old. And he said, this is like Pulp Fiction. It's just like, you know, everybody is going to gawk at this.
Right.
And then I suddenly thought, that whole idea of, I did this for you. I mean, my idea of hell is somebody saying, look what I did for you, you know. And suddenly you realize it's marketing. What else would we pay attention to as human beings, but this grisly, awful, morbid thing? This kind of suffering that would say that our suffering, I understand. I mean, you're not going to look at that and say, oh, you don't know about suffering. You're God. What do you know about suffering? You're going to look and say, oh, you were a hunk of meat like me?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's a radical, that idea of descending theology of the spirit being in these hunks of flesh. It's it's a big deal.
Yeah. You know, we talked a little bit about truth when we started speaking a little while ago, and how, what a kind of troublesome concept it is for modern people, whether there is any such thing as truth. And as a memoirist, I mean, you work so intimately and honestly, kind of being honest about the complexity of how, you know, what you remember at any given moment, the truth that you're remembering at any given moment is shifting depending on who you have become, right? What you can see.
Right.
But I wonder how, in Christianity, in Catholicism, in religion, religion works with truth. So how do you think about, how does your Catholicism flow into your sense of what truth is, how to work with that as a modern person?
Say that again, that last part.
How being Catholic, you know, how your reverence for something like what you were just describing, like It's a big deal, right? I mean, we're talking about something that is, I mean, even the incarnation, especially the incarnation, is on the one hand the most literal, concrete, elemental image you could have, but it's absolute mystery too. But it's in, right. But in Catholicism, it's in the realm of truth. It's just, so I mean, I wonder if you have conversations about things like this, you know, with people who aren't religious and who are very sophisticated and intellectual. And
both, yeah. I've done both, but I remember before I did the Ignatian exercises, mm-hmm. which I did like, I don't know, probably around 2000, 98, 99, 2000, it was very metaphorical for me.
Yeah.
It was all very groovy, kind of new agey. Resurrection was, you know, starting over in some kind of hippy dippy way. And in Ignatian spirituality, there's a thing you do where you compose a scene with your body, with all the senses. The compose is the way Saint Ignatius writes about it. It's like if you're at the nativity, if you're at the crucifixion, what can you smell? What do you touch? What does the cloth feel like on your skin? What do you, you know, hear? What do you feel? You try to put yourself bodily.
Right.
Using your senses into passages from the scripture. As I understand it from my friend George Saunders, who's a Tibetan Buddhist, and with a pretty serious practice, I think, it's not unlike something or some strands of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, that idea of being, you know, putting yourself in a sensory way, a visualization.
Right.
With using the senses and using the body. It's a very powerful practice to take a passage from a scripture and try to ask the Holy Spirit to put you somewhere, to place your mind and your senses in another place. I mean, it's a very radical, dangerous kind of prayer to make. And I did this over 30 weeks, and they give you a lot of different methods of prayer. And somewhere in there, all of the stuff that had been metaphorical became very actual for me.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of my sense of Jesus. I didn't like Jesus when I became Catholic. I came in on the Holy Spirit. I came in on the, you know, kind of, which is a female pronoun, you know, in the Greek scripture. And, you know, I was kind of valley girl about it. And then I got that sense of Jesus that I just noticed that the people who are always doing, you know, running the soup kitchens and taking care of the babies from El Salvador and bringing in orphans, you know, doing all the good stuff and who don't seem really angry and crazy and kind of pissed off and really pious. They seem kind of realistic, always talked about Jesus all the time. So I thought, I've got to get on this Jesus boat. You know, I've got to get it with this Jesus program. And somewhere in there, all of that, I just found that I was able to practice it. Do I doubt all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, there are days that I wake up. I mean, to me, being a Catholic is like any spiritual practice. It's a practice. It's not something you believe. It's not doctrine. Doctrine has nothing to do with it. It's a set of actions.
Yeah.
You know, everybody talks about the doctrine. Do you believe in this? Do you believe in that? What do you do on a day?
Yeah.
You know, do you get on your knees? Do you try to practice charity? Do you try to apologize for your mistakes? Are you trying to live a life that, you know, is less shameful than the one the day before?
Right.
You know.
So I think that idea of sacred carnality comes in again. That, I mean, right. So the truths that that the educated among us can get so hung up about and kind of uncomfortable with asserting are cerebral, and you can debate them right in there about if something's factual. But you're talking about embodied truth, which is apprehended and lived. And
how are you going to act? I mean, people talk to me all the time. I'm friends with Philip Roth, who obviously doesn't believe in God. But he said, well, you know, it's easy. He's 83. He talks about dying. He said, well, it's easy for you. You know, you're 60. You're Catholic. You believe in this afterlife. I'm like, look, I don't think, the veil is going to be lifted and I'm going to be, flying through the air with a harp, with my mommy and daddy. I mean, I do believe there is something that happens after death. I don't know what it means. And it's not my business. It's not what I'm supposed to be thinking about right now. I'm just not in charge of that. I'm having a hard enough time just getting through the day. So for me, it's very, it's all about practice and practicality and trying to be present, trying to be awake. And that means getting under that fear and anxiety. I mean, for me, being Catholic or having a meditative or spiritual practice is all about just trying to delude myself a little less. It's not about living in this fantasy la-la where the guy with the white beard is going to, lift me up on a cloud. It's none of that does me any good. Thinking about this, I don't need that stuff. Other people can think that way or whatever, but I need to get under that anxiety, under that fear, and try to be present and try to be guided by something bigger than the part of me that wants to, French kiss my FedEx guy. it just does. I need help. I need help, Krista.
So, you're so hard on yourself in your writing, and you write about being hard on yourself, and all the way through, all across your writing, you describe yourself as neurotic, nail bitey. That's a good big adjective. Worrier.
I'm a worrier. Yeah. I'm a fretter.
Yeah, fretter, and. Even what you just said, you're so attentive to the struggle of being alive, and I don't know, let's say being true to whatever your true self is. But I do wonder, and I guess I ask this kind of hopefully. I'm just when I say this, I think as somebody who reads you, it's hard to read how hard you are on yourself, right? So,
oh, but can I say I think I'm less hard on myself than I was even when I wrote.
I wanted to ask as you get older, if you're becoming kinder to yourself.
I've got to tell you, I would not trade. I would not trade the age I am now. Mm. I would not be younger. I would not be a week younger than I am. Because I do feel you can't be compassionate to other people unless you're compassionate to yourself.
Yeah.
You can't love other people unless you love yourself. You can't, unless you have empathy for yourself and your own suffering and your own peccadilloes, you're not going to have it for anybody else. So, it took me a long time, obviously, to come to that, and I go in and out of it. But I have a lot more presence and a lot more joy. I eat a lot more chocolate. I don't know. I mean, my head is a lot quieter after all of this. You know, the 30 years of prayer, in sobriety, 20 years of being Catholic, I marvel and wonder a lot. Mm. I think I spend a lot of time kind of astonished by the human comedy. I mean, the hilarity of it and the beauty of it and just the simple nobility of most people you know, trying to get by.
Yeah.
It's a pretty thing to watch.
Mm-hmm. The last line of The Art of Memoir, you write, none of us can never know the value of our lives or how our separate and silent scribbling may add to the amenity of the world, if only by how radically it changes us, one and by one. You're writing to other people, but, you know, I feel like you, that speaks also to the fact that even as you do that work you're doing on getting by, being better, you know, trying to be better today than yesterday, there is also this, there's this social good, there's this larger, there are these larger ripple effects that get set in motion, even by something. I mean, this is kind of a great mystery of life, even by something like writing memoir about the very particular world in which you grew up, the very particular parents you had.
Right, what Faulkner would call your little postage stamp of reality. I mean, I think it's one thing I say to my friends who are atheists, you know, I say, look, why don't you, I mean, you think I'm so full of horse dookie, why don't you pray every day for 30 days and see if your life gets better? And my guess is that it will, just because if you think, I mean, you know, let's say there's not a God. Let's say I die and there's not a God and the worms eat me and that's the end of it. Being daring to hope every day, it's much more radical, I think, to hope than to live in the despair I was born to. I think it's much more dangerous. I remember asking Tobias Wolff when he saw his movie of This Boy's Life, you know, that great memoir, was it hard to watch? I watched it. I sat behind him and his family and his mother was there. And I said, boy, I said, that was so, I cried. I said, that was so hard for me. Was it hard for you to watch? He said, oh, it was really hard. I said, what was the hardest? And I was thinking, you know, when his stepfather is beating him and he's a young Leonardo DiCaprio, he said, oh, no, that didn't bother me at all. He said, it was the hope. Mm. It was when we're singing Christmas carols thinking, oh, this is going to be great. Mm. And we have this awful, awful family.
Right.
And it's much more radical, much more daring, and much more dangerous to hope.
I think you've said similar things, that it's easier to write about those terrible, dramatic moments and harder to write about tenderness.
Oh, yeah. Happiness writes. Yeah, happiness writes white, as the de Montherland quote. It doesn't really show up on the page. Mm.
Well, I feel like you've said this in a number of ways, but I do want to just kind of ask as we close, how you would start to put words around this vast question of, you know, what this sweep of your experience as a memoirist with the life you've lived, as a poet, and just as a human being, like how you would start to talk about what you've learned or are learning still about what it means to be human. Maybe that surprised you as you've gone along.
There's more joy than I knew. Mm. And the less scared I am, the more joy there is. The less in my head I am, the more south of my neck I live my life, the more awake I am, the more just simple joy there is. People always talk about the sunset and all that. So I don't get any of that. I have zero feeling for nature. But just, you know, watching the, you know, old lady with the walker on my way to the studio, you know, get off the bus in front of me and just watching how it was just so heroic. Mm. I was just looking at it thinking, this is, you know, Homer wrote about this. I mean, just somebody struggling to move down the damn road, you know, with all this effort all by her little ancient self. Good for her. You know, it was just pretty to watch.
Well, Mary, this has just been so beautiful, and I can't thank you enough.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I've always wanted to get to meet you. I'm so excited. Next time you're in New York, let's Let's have a cup of Joe.
I would love to do that. And I bet we know other people in common. Yes. Okay.
Hello.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I'm just one of my producers is asking a question behind the glass, so I'm going to listen to her for a minute and then what was like. Okay. I'm curious about, as a poet and a writer, if there are parts of the scriptural text or passages that inform you or that you work with or that you get inspiration from.
Yeah, I mean, I read the liturgy every day.
You do?
Oh, yeah. It's so cornball, isn't it? I read the liturgy. And, my favorite psalm is the Hanging Psalm. I think I write about it in Lit. I found it in my mother's childhood Bible marked in blue chalk.
Oh, yes. Right.
Such a beautiful psalm. You know, cleanse me with hyssop, you know, is it hyssop, hyssop, whatever the hell it is. Wash me and I'll be whiter than snow. Take away my stone heart and give me a new heart. I mean, what is that but saying, but, you know, make me present.
Yeah. And I remember that part in the book where you kind of discovering those passages underlined in your mother's young hand.
Her little bitty baby hand, yeah. You know, from like 1930 or something. Mm-hmm. And then me finding it, mm-hmm. you know, in like 1999, 98, whatever mm-hmm. it was. I know, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll let you know when we're airing this. And it's just been such a pleasure. And I do plan to find a way to meet you one of these days.
Thank you. Yeah, let's do it. Next time you're in New York. Okay. Where do you live, by the way?
I live in Minnesota. We have our studio in Minnesota. In Minneapolis.
I used to live in Minnesota.
I saw that. You went to McAllister, at least for a little while, right?
I did, for a little while.
do you ever come to Minneapolis?
Only on book tour.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll stay in touch, and it's going to be so great to put this out.
Okay, we'll have a hoot. I can't wait. Thanks for having me.
All right.
All right,
yeah.
My dear.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Bye.